Support for Living on Earth comes from listeners like you. Please make a gift online at loe.org or call 800-893-3377 right now. And thanks.
This month, we commemorate the 200th birthday of British naturalist Charles Darwin. It's said Darwin came up with the single best idea anyone ever had. He published it in 1859 in his book On the Origin of Species. Darwin's unexpectedly popular and controversial idea was that all species of life evolved over time from common ancestors. Darwin's theory of that process, natural selection, changed the world of science and society at large. But even today, the laws of nature Darwin discovered are still hotly debated, and we continue to learn more about the social origins and scientific evolution of Charles Darwin himself. James Moore is co-author of the new book, Darwin's Sacred Cause: How a Hatred of Slavery Shaped Darwin's Views on Human Evolution.
All science begins with certain assumptions about the world. Darwin began with certain assumptions. He believed in history. He believed that everything happens slowly. Everything happens by natural law. These were first principles. These were given for Darwin. Another given for Darwin was that all the races are members of the same family. This was ingrained in him from childhood. And it's what led him to theorize about the common descent of all life.
And on both sides of his family, he comes from a long line of abolitionists. This is going back to the early 19th century.
Yes, it does. Both Darwin's grandfathers were passionately committed to abolishing the slave trade, which flourished at that time. And in 1807, 2 years before Darwin was born, Parliament did abolish the transatlantic slave trade. And in America, the transatlantic slave trade was outlawed a year later. So Darwin was born into a world in which half the battle had been won. But the slaves remained to be emancipated. And to that end, different societies sprang up, all of them supported by Darwin's family.
But it's not until he takes this trip aboard the Beagle that he's confronted directly with what the slave trade really means.
Until Darwin reached South America, he had a theoretical understanding of slavery and its horrors. But when he got to South America, he put shredded flesh on that slave. He saw the instruments of torture. He heard the screams. And suddenly he became fired as never before that this sin, he called it, should be abolished around the world.
And from there, Darwin sees the horrors of slavery revealed as the trip progresses.
He does, you know, outstandingly in Brazil. It's seared into him. He sees the remnants of slavery and the flotsam of slavery. And at the very end of the voyage, just weeks before the Beagle reaches England, they touch back again in Brazil. And it's there that when Darwin's walking past a house on the other side of the wall, he hears shrieks and screams, and he thinks to himself, that can only be a slave being tortured. And he was powerless to do anything about it. And when the Beagle got back to Britain, within a few months, he had, in his private notebooks, declared himself a believer in common descent of all life.
Professor Moore, do you think the echo of that scream was as important for what was to come many years later in Darwin's theory as the species that he collected on his voyage of the Beagle?
The scream that stayed with Darwin for life did as much as anything to kickstart his belief in the evolution of all life, the common descent of all life. Without the evidence of the Galapagos, we wouldn't have an argument for evolution by natural selection. But why he went to the trouble and the risk of assembling that evidence, and in the way that he did, to understand that, we need a deeper explanation. He didn't collect facts, as they were called, at random. There was a reason for what he did, and his reason had precedence in his own experience in his own family. The scream of a tortured slave fired him to touch the untouchable and to develop what he called my theory, the theory of evolution.
I wonder if you might read something from your book. It's on page 182, and it's where he's trading letters with the professor who had been his mentor in England, Professor Lyell.
Oh, yes. His greatest eruption ever in print, an absolute moral bombshell he drops in his journal of researches about the Beagle voyage. Those who look tenderly at the slave owner and with a cold heart at the slave never seem to put themselves into the position of the latter. What a cheerless prospect, with not even a hope of change. Picture to yourself the chance ever hanging over you of your wife and your little children, those objects which nature urges even the slave to call his own, being torn from you and sold like beasts to the first bidder. And these deeds are done and palliated by men who profess to love their neighbors as themselves, who believe in God and pray that his will be done on earth. It makes one's blood boil, yet heart tremble, to think that we Englishmen and our American descendants, with their boastful cry of liberty, have been and are so guilty. You wouldn't find anything like this in a scientific book today. I mean, it's just astonishing. Darwin is making this not simply a moral matter, but a matter of religion.
Kind of interesting that at the time that science was used to sustain slavery.
Science wasn't just used to sustain slavery. Science was constructed and formulated in such a way that it kept the races together or apart. People have recognized differences amongst themselves from time immemorial. In Darwin's day, the notion of separate races, separate types of human being, separately created types of human being, was claimed to be put on a scientific basis, mainly by measuring people's bodies.
You read a lot about how they would kind of feel the bumps in your head and they'd be able to
tell. That's the proximate source of it, yes, yes. In Darwin's Edinburgh, when he was a student in his teens at Edinburgh University, phrenology, measuring bumps on people's heads in order to determine their propensities and their character, was absolutely rife. It was a parlor sport. It was also a serious science. And in the United States in the 1840s and 1850s, this was considered to be the best progressive positive science. And Darwin stood foursquare against that movement. All his research in the 1850s was devoted to undermining something that people thought was the latest science.
It pits him directly with some of the bigwigs in science, particularly in the United States. At Harvard, there was Professor Agassiz, who's really a giant. We're not far from Harvard University right here from our studios, and many things are named after him. And Agassiz is really Darwin's great nemesis.
Louis Agassiz was the greatest popularizer of science in Darwin's day. He had a fabulous influence. He had influence in Washington and from Harvard across the country. And Agassiz believed that a strong creationist America had to resist the amalgamation of black people with white people because God had created them separately. They must not be brought together. And it frankly revolted him. With all of the authority and prestige of Harvard University, Agassiz maintained this throughout his career there.
So the key to debunking the scientific racism of the day was sexual selection. And this is during the Victorian era, we should say. How did Darwin come up with this theory?
Darwin had a theory like no one else had to explain the divergence of the human races. Why we look so different to each other. Why some people have very dark skin and others very light, and their eyes are differently shaped, and thick lips or thin lips, and curly hair or straight hair. All of these things Darwin saw as beauty marks that arose from the selection we make in our sexual partners. He calls it sexual selection. You choose people you think are beautiful, and if you choose a man or a woman with a particular physical characteristic and have children by that person, the children will resemble the parents. And Darwin says this is exactly what goes on in the breeding of fancy animals.
Well, he was born 200 years ago. Happy birthday, Charles Darwin. What would you say to him if he were around now?
Oh, that's a hard one, isn't it? I would remind him of a statement he made towards the end of his life when asked whether in the progress of mankind we might all become immortal. And he said he thought it very unlikely because if nothing ever died, there wouldn't be any life at all.
Well, Professor Moore, it's been a great pleasure. I really appreciate it.
I've enjoyed it, too. Thank you so much.
James Moore and co-author Adrian Desmond's new book is Darwin's Sacred Cause.